everyone. I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key to the Case. Welcome back. Thank you all for joining us once again. Today's case brings us back to Australia and has been on my radar for quite some time now. I noticed there was renewed attention on this case earlier in the year, so I thought now would be the perfect time to cover it with the recent focus and the new information that has come out. Please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show, or even tell a friend or anyone you know about our show. We really appreciate that. All right, let's get into it. Marcia Ryan was 33 years old at the time of her disappearance in 1996. Marcia grew up in Melbourne, the capital of Victoria in Australia, as the youngest of five children. Marcia had three brothers, Mark, Paul, and Tony, and one sister, Diane, and she was welcomed into the world with open arms. Her parents looked forward to having another girl, and her older siblings couldn't wait to have a baby sister. Marcia developed a close relationship with her siblings, especially her sister, Diane, who was 3 years older than her. But sadly, the Ryan family experienced a life-altering tragedy in September 1980 when Marcia was 17 and Diane was 20. Diane was on her way to a party when teenagers driving a stolen car struck her car, which resulted in Diane losing her life. Marcia was one of the first people to come upon the scene in her car, and she, along with her family, were never quite the same after the loss of Diane. September was always a tough month for the family, particularly Marcia. At some point thereafter, Marcia left Melbourne and went what has been described as off the grid in a locality called Dongdinglong in New South Wales. The details are sparse, but Marcia's brother Paul said she was living in this isolated area with an abusive partner. It can be difficult to leave an abusive partner even when you're surrounded by family and friends, but Marcia being alone, a roughly 13-hour drive away from her family, likely made it more difficult. Marcia experienced what was later determined to be drug-induced psychosis while living in Dongdinglong in her early 20s, about 2 years after she moved there. It was known that Marcia was using drugs at the time, but the only drug I've seen mentioned is marijuana, so I'm not sure if she was using other drugs too.
So did she receive treatment or check into a psych ward, or just do you know what happened after that diagnosis?
Yes, she did receive treatment. I don't know exactly how long she was in a facility, but her family was there to help her too. And after this incident, Marcia left that partner and she moved back to Victoria. She settled into Seaford, a beachside suburb of Melbourne, and life began to turn around. Marcia loved motorbikes, scuba diving, swimming, and overall, she was quite adventurous. Her family has described her as bold, independent, and tough. Marcia got a job doing administrative work for her aunt and uncle's transport company in Huntingdale, which is near Seaford, and she built a reputation for being reliable and hardworking. Her uncle said, quote, "She was the most reliable worker you could wish for, positive, proficient, an excellent worker in every way," end quote. It was pointed out frequently that Marcia rarely took a day off from work. If she did, it was for a serious matter, such as surgery she underwent to remove her thyroid. Marcia was loving life. She was a homeowner, and she enjoyed spending time with her dog, Ziggy, a border collie Australian cattle mix who never left her side. The pair had a tight bond, and Ziggy could be protective of Marcia. Marcia told others that she would fill Ziggy's food bowl before work, and when she returned home from work, she'd find that she waited for her to return to eat her food. Although that sounds like a dog who was potentially too anxious or stressed to eat while she was away, the point is Marcia and Ziggy had a special relationship. Now, this next part of the case I'm about to share with you has varying versions of it. I think that's for a couple reasons. One being the amount of time that has passed. When people discuss this case, 28 years later, I think memories are a bit distorted. And then I think there are different perceptions of what occurred, which impacts the way people discuss the events. So in August 1996, the same month Marcia disappeared, she had recently finished renovating her 3-bedroom home, which she'd owned for several years. Marcia lived alone, and she was quite accustomed to that lifestyle. However, she was planning to travel to Queensland for an extended period, and she thought it'd be a good idea to rent out one or two of the rooms in her home to local students to have someone there while she was away, and she could definitely use the extra income.
So you mentioned she lived alone. Do you know if after she got out of that abusive relationship, she started dating again or was seeing anyone?
Yeah, so she had a long-term relationship after the abusive relationship, but that relationship ended a few years before she disappeared. So at this point in her life, in 1996, she was single, living alone. I don't even know if she actually lived with that previous boyfriend. So for all we know, she hadn't lived with someone else in her home for a very long time. So Marcia welcomed a boarder or tenant into her home before her travels to help the person get settled. The tenant participated in an interview with Mem Hook from ABC Gippsland earlier this year, and I learned more about him through this interview. As an aside, ABC Gippsland did a thorough review of Marcia's case earlier this year, so their reporting was really helpful for my research. The first discrepancy relates to when the tenant moved into Marcia's home. The tenant named Stephen said when he moved into Marcia's home, he was attending trade school to become a chef, and he lived there for about a month. Marcia's family was under the impression that he had only been there for several days, so we don't know exactly how long he'd been living in Marcia's home. Seems like a big difference between a few days and a month. But when Stephen was interviewed by ABC Gippsland, it was 27, 28 years later, and it's possible his memory was not 100% correct. Stephen described Marcia as a lovely woman and said they got along really well. He even introduced Marcia to his partner. But Marcia called her mom days before she disappeared and explained that having a tenant in her home was throwing her off. And the words frightened and uncomfortable have even been used to describe her feelings. Marcia sounded really unsettled by the whole situation, and she worried she'd made a mistake. Stephen acknowledges that he's seen all of the reports that say this and that Marcia wanted him out of her home, but he denies this, saying it was quite the opposite and she wanted him there. I think it's possible Marcia was feeling this way, feeling uncomfortable, and she didn't tell Stephen this. And that would mean he's telling the truth, because in that scenario, his perception was that she was perfectly fine with him being in the home.
Yeah, maybe she was kind of a non-confrontational person and, you know, wasn't in her nature to confront someone with her feelings like that, tell them that they make her uncomfortable and are frightened of them.
This is different from him just, you know, not putting the dishes away or like little roommate things that you might confront someone about. This was just a general feeling of her not wanting this person to be in her home anymore. So I think if you are going to confront someone about something like that, at that point, you'd kind of have to be prepared to ask them to leave. Otherwise, you're just creating a really uncomfortable environment for everyone. So again, I believe Stephen when he says that Marcia was fine with him being there. I believe that's his perception. But I think there are enough people who heard from Marcia that she was uncomfortable with him that that's how she felt. On Monday, August 19th, 1996, Marcia went to work as usual, but left early because she was feeling unwell. When Marcia arrived home midday, she called her mom and told her she wasn't feeling well, and some of her comments made her mom feel concerned. Marcia's parents were in Queensland on the Gold Coast. They had a unit there, so they typically spent 3 to 4 months on the Gold Coast each year. Marcia's mom was concerned enough about her conversation that she contacted Marcia's brothers to see if one of them could check on her. And we don't know the full extent of their conversation, but some of what Marcia was saying indicated that she might have been experiencing some paranoia. For example, she mentioned the tenant put feathers and bones in her backyard, and she thought he might be trying to put a hex on her. Marcia's brother Mark went to her home, and Mark is sadly no longer alive. He died in 2016, but he described Marcia as very tired and distressed. A friend of Marcia's came over and made sort of the same assessment. They thought she needed to rest. Marcia slept for a while until her friend returned and woke her up. When Marcia awoke, she decided she was going to drive to Queensland. I mentioned in the beginning how Marcia intended to go there for an extended period, but this was not the day she was planning to go. And I don't even know that she had a set departure date. I couldn't find one in my research. While Marcia was getting ready to go, Mark showed up and tried to stop her from leaving, but she was adamant that she was heading to Queensland. Mark was parked behind her in her driveway, and she told Mark that if he didn't move his car, she would ram into it. And he believed her, so he moved his car. Mark and Marcia's friend watched Marcia pack dog food into her car, but nothing else, and she drove off with her dog Ziggy on that rainy Monday night. Somewhere along the way in what I just shared, it was established that Stephen, the boarder, would be kicked out of Marcia's home. There are a couple of variations of how this went down. Mark said Marcia packed up Stephen's belongings and set them outside when he wasn't home. And Mark agreed to tell Stephen that he'd need to move out so Marcia wouldn't have to deal with it. Stephen's story is that Marcia had nothing to do with him being kicked out of the house, and that it was Mark alone who packed up his stuff and essentially kicked him to the curb. Stephen claims that he was there when Marcia left, and she told him she was leaving a little earlier than planned, but it was not abrupt. He said Marcia was of sound mind. She was not experiencing mental health issues, and he watched her pack a backpack and drive off. An investigator in Marcia's case indicated that Stephen was not there when Marcia departed. He showed up later, and Mark had to tell Stephen to leave. So again, I fear that Stephen's memory here could be a little bit off. And although these variations are a bit strange and confusing, I'll tell you right now that neither Mark nor Stephen are considered suspects in Marcia's disappearance.
So sorry, just to clarify, just because there's conflicting reports of whether Stephen was there or wasn't there. So was he there? Stephen says he was.
I'm going to go with what the investigator said, which was that Stephen was not there when Marcia left. I think the narrative the investigators are going with was that Mark and Marcia packed up the tenant stuff, Stephen's stuff, put it to the curb. Marcia drove off and Stephen was not there during any of that. That's kind of what they're going with. Now, I presented Stephen's side because I think it's important to share his perspective and not just be dismissive of that. But I guess his perspective is coming this year. He shared this in an interview this year. So I would like to know if it changed at all from the beginning. And Mark isn't here anymore to share his side, but his story, as he related over the years, stayed consistent. After Marcia drove off with Ziggy, she stopped at an ATM near Melbourne and withdrew a small amount of cash. This was the last activity on Marcia's bank account. She made a call from a public phone to her parents between 11 p.m. and midnight and told them she was headed to Queensland where they were. She told them not to talk her out of it. No one knows where this call was made from since it was a public phone. That was the last time anyone in Marcia's family spoke with her. The fastest route from Marcia's home in Seaford to the Gold Coast would take about 18 hours. So no one was immediately concerned when they hadn't heard from Marcia in the day or two after she left. That is a long drive, and they figured she would have stopped somewhere in the middle to break up the drive. Marcia's brothers went to her house a few times in the days that followed her departure, just in case she changed her mind and returned home. While they were there, they checked her voicemails, and there wasn't much of note until Friday. So she left Monday night, and by Friday, Tony heard a voicemail from a truck driver who found Marcia's wallet on the highway in Darnum when he pulled over due to having issues with his truck. Darnum is east of Seaford, where Marcia lived, and it's a little more than an hour's drive away. Tony wondered why in the world Marcia's wallet was on the highway like this, and if Marcia had taken the most direct route from Seaford to her parents' location in Queensland, she would not have passed through Darnum. To make matters more puzzling, the cards in Marcia's wallet were scattered all over the road, which made it appear that someone had thrown the wallet out of a car window while they were driving. Now, the wallet and its contents were scattered across the lanes of the highway headed east, and the median between the eastbound and westbound lanes was so large that made it pretty much impossible for someone driving west to have thrown the wallet and have it end up in the eastbound lane. So to date, the belief is that someone driving in the lanes headed east threw the wallet out their window. By that point, Tony met up with the person to retrieve the wallet and then contacted his local police to report the situation. But Tony explained that the police looked in their system and found there had been sightings of Marcia in Moe and Morwell. And Moe and Morwell are two cities near each other, and they are east of Darnum, where her wallet was found. Moe is a little more than 20 kilometers or 13 or so miles away from Darnum. So if you're following the geography here, Moe and Morwell are farther away from Marcia's home than Darnum. Frankly, I'm not 100% sure how the police got the information about sightings of Marcia and Moe and Morwell. I have a suspicion that I'll mention later. But when Tony learned this, it made some sense to him because he knew Marcia knew people in that area. So he thought maybe she met up with some friends there and that's why no one had heard from her.
Do you know if she's made this drive before, or is this the first time or first couple of times she's done this? And you know, the only reason I'm wondering is if this is the first time, maybe she accidentally took a more roundabout way to get from Seaford to the Gold Coast than, you know, the most direct. But yeah, I'm just wondering if that could be a potential reason why her route seems a little more circuitous.
Yeah, so Marcia had driven to Queensland before. I don't know how many times or if this was the route she would take, but I learned through my research that going through the way it appeared she was traveling, if those sightings were legitimate, that's described as the scenic route. It takes you closer to the coast. So it does take a little bit longer than the most direct route. It would take 2 to 3 hours longer than the other route. So did Marcia intentionally take the scenic route or head that direction? I don't know. But it's not as though she was going in some really bizarre route to get there. It takes a little bit longer. So despite the new information that Tony learned about the potential sightings in Moe and Morwell, he planned to drive to the area to search for Marcia the next day, Saturday. Before setting out to that area, Tony stopped at Marcia's home to check her voicemail for a final time. He heard a message from Vic Rhodes. They were trying to contact Marcia because they found her car parked on the side of the highway and informed her that if she didn't move her car, it would be impounded. Alarmed by this, Tony immediately headed to where her car had been abandoned. Marcia's car was parked in an unusual and seemingly random location on Prince's Highway facing east. Her car was just 1 kilometer before the Yallourn North exit or turnoff between Newborough and Haunted Hills. And this was not far at all, really, from Moe and Morwell. Reports say that Marcia got about 2.5 hours away from home. But when I put the location in Google Maps, I'm seeing more like 1.5 hours. Regardless, it doesn't make a huge difference. The car was about 20 kilometers or 12.4 miles away from where her wallet was found. based on how it was believed that someone driving east threw Marcia's wallet out of their car with the location of Marcia's car, it could have been Marcia herself who threw her wallet from her car. Although no one knows if that's the case. And of course, it's unclear why she would do that. Marcia's car, a 1980 Mitsubishi Sigma sedan, was parked on the narrow shoulder of the highway. This was considered a dangerous place to park. If Marcia needed to rest for a bit, this certainly wouldn't have been the place to do it. Tony got to Marcia's car and found it locked. No one was around the vehicle and Ziggy was not inside. Tony broke into her car, but he found nothing of mention inside. There was nothing of value. An investigator in Marcia's case told ABC Gippsland that Marcia's car was found unlocked with the keys in the ignition, and Tony concurred that he was told this as well, but it was locked when he got to it. I learned that the police actually came upon Marcia's car several days earlier in the early morning hours of Tuesday, August 20th, and they removed the keys and locked the car. So the police had the keys now and apparently have had them since the initial investigation. So Tony was a little confused. He said he's never seen the keys and he wasn't sure why they wouldn't have just given him the keys. Instead, they gave him a coat hanger to break into her car. So he seems a little bit skeptical of the fact that they have the keys, but that's what has been reported. So my thinking is that those sightings of Marcia and Moe and Morwell I told you about earlier were related to her vehicle since the police were already aware it was there and had been there since not very long after she left her home. Marcia parking her car on this narrow shoulder, a less than ideal location, and leaving the keys in the ignition points to an abrupt departure from her car or possibly a lack of awareness. It was widely reported that Marcia's vehicle was out of fuel. So the idea was that Marcia pulled over because she ran out of fuel and she got out of her car, Ziggy, to get fuel. This seemed to be the belief for a long time for everyone. But jumping ahead for one moment, when Marcia's case was reopened recently, they established that her petrol gauge was broken in her car and she likely did not run out of petrol.
I mean, did they check the tank when they, I'm assuming the car went in as evidence. Did anyone see if it was out of gas?
It seems like common sense, right? This part of the story is so baffling to me because it seems like this shouldn't be a question, but let's get into this in a moment. But Tony had the car towed since he didn't have the keys. He couldn't even try to start the car, right? So Tony had the car towed to his house and then later the police would take it in as evidence and they saw that it said her petrol was on empty. I'm wondering if everyone just took that for what it was. No one checked if she actually had fuel in her car and they moved on because I don't understand why it would take a reopening of the case to make that determination. And some people have pointed out that Marcia would have known this about her car. So she should have known, you know, the gauge was broken, she had gas, everything was okay. But I've wondered if that's right. I mean, it's unclear when the gauge broke. It could have been something that happened on that drive, but I suppose that's not super likely either. I just point that out because it doesn't appear anyone she knew was aware of this issue. And it seems like something you might mention to at least one person. Tony told ABC Gippsland that after breaking into Marcia's car and discovering she was nowhere in sight, he thought Marcia may have hitchhiked. Hitchhiking would not be out of the question for Marcia because they grew up hitchhiking. It was a normal occurrence. So logically, he's thinking she ran out of petrol, so she and Ziggy hitched a ride from someone to go get petrol. And now they just need to find out where she is and why she didn't return to her car. So as I just mentioned, Marcia's car needed to be removed from the road, so Tony had it towed to his house. But by Saturday night, the same day he had the car towed, he received a call from the police and they told him basically, he needed to take a step back and stop interfering with the investigation because they were treating it as a homicide at that point. Tony was taken aback. He was not trying to interfere with any investigation, But he didn't understand why they were treating her disappearance as a homicide. What information did they have, right, that he didn't have? But he listened to them and took a step back and let them do their jobs. By then, Marcia's parents were worried and left Queensland and went back to Melbourne. Around the same time, major searches were underway in the area where Marcia's car was abandoned. The searches involved 150 police and state emergency service workers spanning a 30-kilometer or 18.6-mile radius. The searches have been described as exhaustive and included the use of a helicopter, yet they found no sign of Marcia or Ziggy. Police searched Marcia's home and car as well and found nothing suspicious. As the news of Marcia's disappearance began to spread across Victoria and Queensland, a few people came forward to say they believed they saw Marcia in the area around her car, but only one of those sightings has been confirmed. So we'll start with that one. A truck driver named Bob heard about Marcia's disappearance on the news, and when he saw her face and learned where her car was found, he immediately thought back to an encounter he had while driving on Prince's Highway late Monday night, the same night Marcia left her home and abandoned her car. Bob told police that he saw Marcia walking along Prince's Highway around 11:50 p.m. She was walking east away from Melbourne. So another way to think about it is she parked her car on the side of the highway, got out, and walked straight. She did not turn around and walk against traffic. Seeing this set off alarm bells for him. It wasn't an area where people should be walking in the darkness, especially on a rainy night.
When she was spotted, did anyone see Ziggy with her?
No. So Marcia was alone, based on Bob's statements, and he remembers that very clearly because he told Mim Hook with ABC Gippsland that he's a dog person, so it would have been no big deal for him to give Marcia and her dog a ride somewhere if she had Ziggy with her. Bob pulled over next to Marcia to ask if she needed any help or needed a ride, and she approached him and said everything was okay, and she refused any assistance from Bob. Bob said she was a bit brusque, but not rude. She was just adamant that she didn't need help, and she didn't provide any details about why she was walking on the highway, what she was doing, where she was going. After the news came out about Marcia's disappearance, Bob learned that she was potentially out of petrol. Again, that was likely not the case, but it's what was believed at the time. And he told ABC Gippsland that she was very close to a 24-hour service station that he could have driven her to, although you'd kind of have to be familiar with the area to know it was there. So he was frustrated to learn this. Bob stopped for a second time, but Marcia refused help again. While he spoke with her, he suggested she walk on the other side of the road so drivers heading east could see her more easily. So Marcia went to the other side of the road. And it's interesting to me that Marcia didn't want help. On one hand, it makes sense because Marcia was so independent and resourceful. But on the other hand, she was used to hitchhiking, so she likely wouldn't have been uncomfortable accepting help from a truck driver in a situation like that. But I also think about if she were looking for Ziggy, if that's why she was wandering around, then getting in this truck driver's vehicle isn't going to help her in that scenario. And where exactly Bob saw Marcia is up for debate. It was somewhere between 200 and 1500 meters away from her car. Pretty broad range, but sources vary on that detail. The police looked into Bob. They wanted to make sure that his story checked out. Bob's truck company was testing GPS devices at that time, and Bob happened to drive one of the trucks that was equipped with GPS. So they were able to track his movements, and they aligned exactly with his assigned route. There were no deviations. Additionally, Bob was known to occasionally assist people in situations like this, so it didn't strike anyone as unusual that he would stop to try to help someone. Investigators found no evidence to support Bob being involved in Marcia's disappearance. So Bob's sighting is considered the only confirmed sighting, but there were a few unconfirmed sightings of Marcia. According to ABC Gippsland, a different truck driver named Brian was driving on Prince's Highway the night of August 19th, the day Marcia left home, sometime between 11:30 p.m. and 12:30. He saw a car matching Marcia's description on the side of the road in the same approximate location of where Marcia's car was ultimately found. Then the next day, Tuesday, August 20th, he was driving behind a friend near the same area on Prince's Highway around the same time of night when he saw something on the side of the road out of the corner of his eye. He looked toward the tree line, which is approximately 20 feet from the highway, and saw a woman move from a standing position to a squatting position. She kind of crouched down, and his impression was that this woman was trying to hide. Brian continued driving until he and the friend he was following stopped. He told his friend about the situation, and Brian wanted to go back and check on the woman, but his friend brushed it off, so they carried on driving. Brian learned of Marcia's disappearance and thought she resembled the woman he saw in the trees. When interviewed by ABC Gippsland, Brian was open about how, although he thought the woman looked like Marcia, he wasn't certain that it was her. I definitely think Brian saw something, some movement. He seems credible. I don't think he imagined that, but the big question is, did he see Marcia? And if he did, what was she doing? And why was she still in the same area as she was 24 hours before? If he did see Marcia, it would make more sense that he got his nights mixed up and he saw her Monday night when the other truck driver saw her, but he seemed confident in his days. So if he did see Marcia on Tuesday night, a whole day after the other truck driver saw her, this is concerning and could support Marcia's mental state not being at its best.
I'm surprised Brian was able to make out her face in the darkness as he's going by on the highway. Like, it seems like a lot of factors there that it would just kind of make someone's face look like a blur.
Right, because you're moving quickly, it's dark. Yeah, and I hadn't mentioned this yet, but Marcia's brother, Tony, went out to the area where her car was parked and filmed a video of it that he posted on YouTube back in 2017. So, of course, the area is not exactly the same in 2017 as it was in 1996, but he actually went there when it was dark, and there are no street lights, there are no people around. The only people around are in cars. So Marcia walking along Prince's Highway at this time would have been faced with a lot of darkness. The only light would have been from headlights illuminating the road or possible moonlight. So it really would have been scary, I think, at that time of night. Of course, we don't have a video of the very specific spot where he saw a woman in the tree line, but yeah, it is surprising that he would be able to make out her features. And he said people have just kind of dismissed him over the years about this. So I don't want to fall into doing that too. Like, I believe he saw something for sure. It's just a matter of, did he see Marcia? Another witness named Stewart came forward to police to share that on Tuesday, August 20th, he was driving out of Mowi on Prince's Highway when he saw what he believed to be Marcia's car on the side of the road. Stewart saw a woman who matched Marcia's appearance standing at the back left side of the vehicle and possibly a set of keys and a handbag on the trunk or boot of the sedan. He recalled a white station wagon in front of the sedan with two men standing near it and one was smoking a cigarette. Stewart did not see a dog. Stewart went to the police a few weeks after he saw this, and once he learned of Marcia's vanishing, he thought the car and woman he was seeing on the news matched what he saw on August 20th. The police disregarded Stewart's potential sighting because Stewart said the car he thought was Marcia's was parked at an angle, and the police said Marcia's car wasn't, although it was parked at a bit of an angle. So this could have been Marcia, and if that's the case, then two men were in contact with her that day who haven't come forward. However, I have some reservations about this sighting because how would Marcia have gotten back to her car after the first truck driver sighting? Did she walk? Did she get a ride? If she got a ride, no one came forward to say they drove her to her car. So I don't know. I can see why this one is considered unconfirmed, but it shouldn't be dismissed. And I actually think it would have been helpful for the police to share this information with the public when they received it, so that if these were other people on the side of the road, just random innocent people, they could have come forward and said, no, that was me, and ruled out this possibly being Marcia. But from what I could find, they didn't do that. They just brushed him off. The final unconfirmed sighting came from Allison Lester, a children's author. During the same week Marcia disappeared, Allison was driving to Melbourne on Princes Highway, where she lived, and she was slightly east of Darnham when she saw a woman and a man walking with a dog on a leash. They were on the right side of the right lane with the median beside them and walking toward her or against traffic, so she saw them head on. This situation stuck out to her because she thought it was odd for someone to be walking a dog in that area at that time of night. These people were walking away from Melbourne, but the approximate location she described would take several hours to walk to from where Marcia's car was parked. It would only take 20 minutes to drive there. Allison said she probably would have stopped if the woman were alone, but she chose not to stop when she saw the woman was accompanied by a man. Allison described the dog they were walking as a mixed cattle dog, and it was black and white, which does match Ziggy's description. As with the other potential witnesses, Allison heard about Marcia's disappearance from the media. She wondered if the woman she saw could have been Marcia, since that woman resembled her. Allison kept this information to herself for a while, but when she finally decided to go to the police, they didn't take her sighting seriously, and it essentially went nowhere. If she saw Marcia, then whoever that man was has some explaining to do. However, we'll likely never know if Allison saw Marcia or not. And I do know that Marcia didn't keep Ziggy on a leash a lot, and I don't even know if she packed a leash. So that's one variable here, that if we know for sure Marcia, or if we knew for sure Marcia didn't bring a leash, then the man would have had to have supplied a leash. And I don't know what the odds are of that, but I guess it would make it a little less likely that this was Marcia. But again, it's not like people were just walking on this road all the time with a dog, or walking at all, really. Investigators received another tip, but this one was unlike the others. A woman from Victoria, unclear exactly where, claimed that one day, about a year after Marcia's disappearance, her brother-in-law came to her and her husband, so his brother, white as a sheet, and told them he made a jarring discovery. This man was in Mundara State Park, which is north of Moi, when he stumbled upon two shallow graves, one smaller grave and one larger. According to him, a hand was protruding from the larger grave. The brother-in-law wanted to show them the graves, but first, the woman went to the police to report the situation. She was met by a young policeman who made her wait so long to speak with her that she eventually left without speaking to anyone. This woman couldn't bring herself to go see the graves, and a bushfire burned the area shortly after, destroying any evidence. I imagine it was clear, but the idea here is that the smaller grave belonged to Ziggy and the larger grave belonged to Marcia. Mundara State Park was not included in the search efforts, and it's close enough in proximity that the graves could have been theirs. This is deeply frustrating because if this woman and her brother-in-law's story is true, then someone's remains could have been recovered, Marcia or not, had she persisted, or if the police had responded more quickly. The man who made the discovery, the brother-in-law, has since passed away. So what do you think about this detail?
I think it's possible that the two graves could have belonged to Marcia and Ziggy. Maybe it is true that she was walking on the side of the road on the highway, and someone could have potentially hit both her and Ziggy, and whoever hit them could have taken them to this park and buried them.
Yes, that is one of the theories, I think, in this case. And I think what makes this feel possible, at least that these graves belong to Marcia and Ziggy, is the proximity. Like I said, it was not that far. I don't know exactly where in the state park the graves were, so I can't give you an exact distance, but this park is just north of Maui, and our car was not far from Maui. So I don't want to write it off, but it does bother me that we kind of seems like we just have the one man who saw the graves. I wish we had other people to corroborate this. And again, I just go back to, man, if the police had responded to this woman more quickly, maybe we would be discussing this case differently now. I feel like we've discussed so much since we discussed the tenant, Stephen, but I want to revisit him for just a moment. The police couldn't get in contact with him for the first several days since Marcia's disappearance was reported, but he was at a friend's house after being kicked out, and he was unaware she was missing. During his interview, Stephen said he got a tattoo and a piercing during those days, and he was busy doing drugs. As I said earlier, Stephen is not considered a suspect. We know he didn't follow after her in his car when she left. And I think for him to be involved, he would have had to have followed her when she left her home. Marcia's case was at an impasse for years with no new information or leads. Investigators didn't know where to go. In 2023, they tested some of Marcia's belongings, including her wallet, with the hope of collecting a foreign DNA sample, but there were no foreign DNA profiles recovered from her belongings. With no crime scene or remains, there is little opportunity for further DNA testing. As recently as this year, it was reported that the Morwell police are reopening the investigation into Marcia's disappearance. Morwell police indicated that the initial investigation was extensive and adequate, but they hope a fresh set of eyes will prove beneficial. The Morwell police are working on Marcia's case when they can. They don't have a dedicated investigator or investigators reviewing her case, so they have to work on it as they have time. There are a few main theories in this case. Marcia and Ziggy died by accident, by succumbing to the elements. Marcia died by suicide, Marcia disappeared willingly, or Marcia was a victim of foul play. In the earlier days of Marcia's disappearance, the theory that Marcia chose to leave her life was prominent, but 28 years later, her family no longer puts weight in this. But if you think about it, if Marcia threw her wallet out of her car, which is possible, and willingly abandoned her vehicle, then she was ridding herself of items that could identify her. So I can see why this theory was considered early on.
Yeah, especially if she had some sort of mental episode. I do think this is plausible if there's a bunch of stuff bubbling up to the surface and she finally, you know, reached her breaking point. She could have decided to take the thing she loves most in the world, Ziggy, and go start a new life.
Yes, in the mental state she was in, she could have thought that was her best decision at that moment, and she could have felt extremely stressed. So even if she had those intentions, which she did call her parents and say she was headed to Queensland, so that doesn't jibe with this theory, but if she had those intentions, then what happened to her after that? Marcia's brother, Paul, doesn't believe she disappeared deliberately and wouldn't have been found after all these years. I think, again, her family put more weight in that in the beginning. And he doesn't think she died by suicide, but he acknowledges that you never know. He doesn't understand how she wouldn't have been found, though. Although Stephen, the tenant, indicated that Marcia was of sound mind when she disappeared, too many other details point to that not being the case. We have her abrupt departure, the comments she made to her mom that sounded as though she might be experiencing some paranoia, and just her behavior overall before she left her home. She didn't even pack a toothbrush before setting out on a lengthy drive. But what was so strange about that was that no one in Marcia's family expected her to have a mental health episode like she did in her early 20s, because she had gone nearly 10 years without one. I imagine by then, that episode felt like a distant memory. Marcia's aunt, who she worked for 10 years, said she showed no signs of mental health struggles, at least openly, during her employment. The point I'm trying to make is that this was not a pattern for Marcia, but it's possible something triggered this. Marcia vanished in August, and September was typically a difficult month for her compared to other months because it was the anniversary month of her sister's death. Could the looming reminder, combined with having a new person in her home, have caused major stress for Marcia?
Especially one that she described as frightening and a person that makes her uncomfortable. Maybe this person was bringing up her past trauma with her abusive partner.
Yes. And I mentioned earlier that Stephen openly said he did drugs. I don't know if he was using drugs in her home. Don't want to speculate too much, but if he did, then that could have been triggering as well, because we know when Marcia had her incident in her early 20s, it was related to drugs. But I think you're right. And her brothers think Stephen moving in could have been the tipping point for her. But even if Marcia was not of sound mind when she disappeared, which I believe is accurate, that doesn't explain how she vanished completely, but it could have caused her to behave differently from how she normally did. She could have become confused, wandered into the bush, and succumbed to the elements. But where was Ziggy in all of this? I don't know, but some have questioned if she may have let Ziggy out of the car to go to the bathroom. Ziggy ran off and she chased after her, getting lost and eventually separated. The extensive searches for Marcia and Ziggy should make this type of scenario less likely, but it's not impossible. Conversely, Marcia could have experienced a mental health episode that put her in a more vulnerable state, and someone took advantage of a woman walking alone at night. Or as you suggested, Sean, she could have been hit by a driver. The conditions that night were not safe for her to be walking on the road. So I think she was at risk of being hit by a vehicle just by walking on that road. But had she tried to cross and a car was coming, they probably wouldn't have had time to slow down depending on where she was. So again, that's the thing though with this case is that there's no evidence to prove any theory. What seems surefire is that Marcia, in her typical mental state, would not have left Ziggy. They were always together. So Ziggy is a big mystery here. I can only hope that someone picked her up as a stray somewhere and took her in or rehomed her, and maybe they never knew Ziggy was a missing woman's dog. There were various possible sightings of Ziggy, but nothing was confirmed. And as Marcia's brother pointed out, a cattle dog mix in a farming area was not unusual.
It seems strange to target a woman and her dog if she was a victim of foul play for someone who, you know, picked her and the dog up. But on the other hand, they could have just targeted her and forced her into the vehicle and forgot about the dog.
Yeah, and then Ziggy lost his way somewhere. Or the other thought I had was maybe by that point, she had found Ziggy, or she was with Ziggy all along, and maybe the first truck driver didn't see Ziggy, but maybe she finally accepted help from someone who pulled over, and then something happened from there. So in that scenario, they wouldn't have necessarily been forced into a vehicle. But yeah, I guess in this case, I kept thinking of Marcia and Ziggy as whatever happened to Marcia also happened to Ziggy, but it's certainly possible that something happened to Marcia and what happened to Ziggy was something separate. He could have gotten lost, or like I just suggested, he could have been picked up as a stray and no one ever put two and two together. But that's kind of the frustrating thing about this case is it feels like there's an infinite number of possibilities of what could have happened to Marcia with pretty much no evidence. Marcia's mom died in 2006. Her dad died in 2013, and her brother Mark died in 2016. Marcia's other brothers, Paul and Tony, continue to hold out hope that Marcia's case will be solved one day. Tony has said that when he retires, he hopes to take a metal detector out to Mundara State Park in hopes of finding Ziggy's collar. The police will not be searching that area without more specific information as to where Marcia and Ziggy could be. So it's really up to Marcia's brothers and anyone willing to help to search for her. If you have information related to the disappearance of Marcia Ryan, please contact the Morwell Police. Thank you all for joining us for this absolutely tragic case. That is all for now, but we will be back next week with a new case. Bye.
Bye.